Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. If you ever donated blood, you know that there's a form to fill out beforehand to determine if you're eligible. And for nearly 40 years, it took into consideration gender and sexual orientation. That individual donor assessment that blood centers have to follow comes from the Food and Drug Administration. The guidelines began with a lifetime ban back in 1985 for men who have sex with men. And then in the decades since, the FDA scaled back, allowing for gay and bisexual men to donate blood as long as they abstain from sex. All of that is now a thing of the past. Now everyone is screened equally, regardless of gender and sexual orientation. Vitalant is one of the largest blood centers in the country, with many locations here in Northern California. The nonprofit was also the lead research organization behind the FDA's change. Dr. Chris Gressens is the senior chief medical officer for Vitalant and joins us with more on the changes and what the response has been so far. Good morning, Dr. Gressens.
Good morning, Ms. Gonzalez, and thank you for allowing me to share with you and your audience a little bit about what's going on.
Yeah, it's been a few months since you last joined us. You joined us on Insight back in May, and that was following the FDA's announcement of these new blood donation eligibility guidelines. Remind us why the FDA took gender and sexual orientation into consideration when it came to people who wanted to donate blood.
Sure. So once upon a time, as you correctly shared, going back 40 years, we had to paint, unfortunately, with a very broad brush because we didn't have the tools now at our disposal for ensuring the continued safety of the blood supply. Many, many thousands of people, including 10 out of 20,000 people with hemophilia A, were infected from HIV. And most of those infections admittedly did occur in association with blood coming from men who had had sex with other men. So the challenge was trying to do this fairly at a time when we didn't have the ideal tools. And as a result, we painted with that very broad brush 40 years ago. We've since pulled back using a narrower and narrower brush, to the point where, as of just last month early, we're using a 3-month deferral from time of last male-to-male sexual contact as our deferral criterion. However, we didn't believe that was good enough. We believe we have better tools at our disposal now, and that's why we've done just what you've said and taken away that last, what we believe was inappropriate and unfair mandate. And I can share with you a little bit more about what we're doing now as you'd like.
Yeah, I mean, given that Vitalant officially moved forward with these new guidelines late last month, it's just been a couple weeks. Walk us through what's different.
Thank you. So nowadays, rather than asking about a history of male-to-male sexual contact, instead we talk about risk factors related to sexual contact in general, irrespective of somebody's sexual background. So for instance, we ask if someone has had any new partners, new sexual partners in the last 3 months, or more than one sexual partner. That's getting at where the risk really resides. And it makes sense. People who have had recent new sexual partners are at risk for new exposures if the other partner has a disease. And people who have multiple sexual partners, just by pure logic as well as the facts that we found, are at greater risk as well. Hmm. So that alone, though, isn't enough to defer the donor. In other words, if somebody says, yes, I had a new sexual partner 2 months ago, we then ask a follow-up question. And that specifically is, did that sexual contact involve anal sex? And the reason for that is we know from a pure biologic, physiologic, mechanical perspective that HIV is more easily transmitted through anal sex. So if the two converge, if somebody says, yeah, I have a new sexual partner in the last 3 months or more than one sexual partner, and it involved anal sex, that's the only time we would defer. And that's a 3-month deferral from last contact. I'm glad to speak further to that, but that's the nutshell version.
You know, given that, you know, there are other countries that have implemented this change ahead of the United States. Some include Canada and the United Kingdom. What was there to learn from them?
Thanks for asking. This was one of those cases where we're not at the top of the or the front of the wave, if you will. We allowed other colleagues elsewhere to learn from their experiences and share with us. And what we've seen so far is there does not seem to be any increased risk to the safety of the blood supply. That doesn't surprise us, but still, sometimes, no matter how good the research you do, you find out afterwards that there are uncontrollable variables that lead to other results. So we're very pleased that post-change surveillance shows no significant changes in safety, whether in several Western European countries or Canada. We, however, also will continue to monitor closely along with FDA just to make sure the same holds true in the U.S. The other question becomes, how many more blood donations do we get from that change? And we are hopeful, based upon what we're seeing in other countries, small, low single-digit incremental increases. We're hopeful that we'll have similar improvement. You might say, well, what does a single-digit mean? Well, if you're just barely treading water in meeting the transfusion needs of your patients, 1% more blood can be everything. So we're hopeful that as we become more inclusive, more welcoming, that one benefit among several, the major benefit is we'll be able to help more patients.
Yeah, people may be surprised to know, and this is on your website, that of those who are eligible to donate blood, I mean, currently only about 3% donate blood. So, and I know that this has only been a couple weeks since you've rolled out these changes, but what has been the response been thus far in the last 2 to 3 weeks?
Thus far, Vicki, it's been more anecdotal in that if I might share with you a couple of discussions I've had with friends, in this case, two married couples, male-male married couples, who have indicated to me how delighted they are that now they'll finally be able to donate. That was a good feeling. That was a feeling of warmth, knowing that people whom I've known for a couple of decades would make wonderful donors finally can come into the tent and join us. And both of them have scheduled, one partner of each of those marriages has scheduled donations. We don't know yet just how many more new donors are going to come in as a result of this. In a few months, though, we can provide you an update.
Is there going to be more outreach or an awareness campaign? Because although these changes have taken place, it doesn't mean that people know that, especially since there have been restrictions for nearly 40 years.
Well, absolutely. We don't want to whisper on a windy day here. We want to shout this out, and we really are trying to do that, but I think there's more we can do, in particular in collaboration with LGBT community leadership. So we certainly are making some inroads there. Quite frankly, I think there's more we can do, and my senior team executives are working on just that.
What should transgender, non-binary, or transitioning individuals, what should they expect when filling out the form to donate blood with Vitalant?
Yeah, thanks for asking. Number one, I want to say that we welcome people from all of those groups, all those populations of fellow human beings. It is just a little bit more complicated, and here's why. We also need to take into account safety considerations regarding how much blood we remove, because some of our considerations when we calculate, for instance, blood volumes are still predicated on male versus female statistics. I believe in the next 5 to 10 years, as we look at patients and by extension blood donors, we'll subdivide into more than just those binary two categories. But for safety reasons, if a male to female transitioned person were to donate, that blood volume calculation would be slightly different than the converse if a female to male donor were to come in. So we do have to account for that, and we apologize for some of the extra questions, usually only an extra minute or two this will entail. But for the time being, it's the best we can thread our way through, making sure we are inclusive, yet at the same time we don't put our donors at risk. Does that start to answer your question,
Yeah,
Vicki?
it seems like there still are more questions, which leads me to my final question, because Vitalant was instrumental in the research that led to the FDA updating its guidelines. What are the next steps for research in this area?
Yeah, well, we'll do not unlike when any new medication comes out and there's what's known as post-marketing surveillance. We're going to do the same. This isn't a medication, but it's a major change. So we're going to look at two major issues. Number one, does the safety of the blood supply remain constant, or ideally even better? But certainly we want to make sure that this is at least a zero-sum game as far as safety. And then number two, we do want to see what impact this has on increased donations, because again, every little bit helps. So over the next months to few years, we'll know more.
Dr. Gressens, thank you for the time.
Thank you so much, Vicki. And if I could just encourage, final comment, when you mention only 3% of adults donate, that contrasts to 62% or thereabouts of adults actually being able to donate. If we could bump that 3% up to 4%, anyone who's listening who might be interested in donating, please do go to vitalant.org, and we'd be happy to let you know if you can join the gang. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Chris Gressens is the Senior Chief Medical Officer for Vitalant, one of the largest blood donation centers, which has just implemented the FDA's updated guidance, opening eligibility to more gay and bisexual men to donate blood. For the first time in 40 years, blood donor eligibility is determined regardless of gender or sexual orientation. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. The issue of reporting transgender and gender nonconforming students to their parents has taken center stage at school board meetings in California. Last week, Rockland Unified School District in Placer County approved a policy that would require schools to notify parents if their child identifies under a different name or gender than that assigned at birth. Less than a day later, Orange Unified School District in Southern California did the same. According to EdSource, a total of 6 school districts have passed a transgender parental notification policy within the past 2 months. Those opposed say the move essentially outs students to their families, violates students' privacy, and puts them at risk of harmful backlash, including toxic or non-accepting households. Those in favor argue that students' rights don't supersede a parent's right to know, and that the policy is intended to increase communication between schools and families. This passionate debate is also playing out in court following a legal challenge by California Attorney General Rob Bonta. In a moment, we're going to be joined by 2 advocates for trans and gender nonconforming students. But first, Diana Lambert is a senior reporter with EdSource who's been following the latest on these policy changes that are being passed and the legal challenges that they're facing. Good morning, Diana.
Good morning, Vicki.
So this is a big issue. Lots of emotion on both sides. These school board meetings go into the early morning hours. They go on for a long time. So let's start by explaining what these policies are intended to do, given that they just started to spring up within the last 2 months.
Well, the policies are called parental notification policies, and they require school staff to inform parents if a student asks to change their name, the pronoun, or asked to take part in a program or use a facility associated with a gender other than the ones they were born with.
Are there differences in the policies from one school board to another? Or are they pretty much the same?
You know, they're very similar, but there are some differences. In Rockland, they have an addendum which says that if you think a child is in danger, you call CPS instead of their parents. So there are slight changes, but they're very similar, and some of them are identical.
So is this all a coincidence, or who's behind these policy updates or changes since they're all happening around the same time? How did this begin?
Well, it all started with Assembly Bill 1314 by Assemblyman Bill Asaley. It didn't really get any traction in the legislature. So then they came up with a model policy that they've been shopping around to school districts. And some have used it and others have modified it. And that's why we're seeing similar policies sprouting up across the state.
Why shop them around to school districts?
Well, I mean, they're shopping them around to board members is what they're doing. Board members who might feel like they want these sorts of policies. So they're making them available as a format, but it's up to the school board members to present them to their boards and get a vote.
And board members are elected positions, correct?
They are elected positions.
Generally speaking, what is the argument in favor of these policies? You have watched these school board meetings play out.
Right. They're similar to what you just said. Parental rights is the overwhelming theme here. And so they're saying parents have the right to know what is going on in their children's lives, and students don't really have a right to privacy as minors.
What stands out to you about the arguments against these policies? I mean, oftentimes we hear students speaking against these policies as well at school board meetings.
Oh, I mean, students are definitely stepping up, and so are teachers. I mean, most teachers are against these policies. They're afraid they'll be dangerous to students and they'll drive a wedge between the communication between teachers and students.
Given that the school districts, I mean, they skew politically more conservative. You have a school district in Orange County, Rockland Unified School District in Placer County, Temecula Valley Unified, Anderson Union High School District, Murrieta Valley Unified, and Chino Valley Unified. What role is politics and the political makeup playing in this?
Well, it's playing a big role in this. As a matter of fact, there was a big push during the last election by the Republican Party to flip school boards, so they would have a conservative majority so they could pass policies like this. They weren't really that successful, but they're continuing to try, and they're already recruiting for the next election cycle.
What stands out to you about the mood, you know, when you watch these school board meetings, especially Rockland Unified, that's in our area, it's in Placer County, it's about a half hour away?
Well, definitely. I spoke to teachers and parents after the meetings, and they said, in Temecula, I'll talk about Temecula, they said they didn't have a divisive school community before these policies, but now it's very divisive. And you're seeing the same thing in Rockland. It's sort of tearing apart the school community.
Are other school boards, you know, to your knowledge, considering taking up similar policies like these?
Absolutely. I spoke to Jonathan Zacherson, and he's on Rockland City Unified School District, and he said that they expect two more boards in Placer County to take up these policies. We should see their agendas this week, and they expect even more.
Legally, I mean, can teachers be liable, or school staff? Can you be liable if you out students to their parents? I mean, is that actually legally possible?
Yes, I spoke to a couple attorneys about this and wrote a story about this a couple weeks back, and they said definitely they could be liable because they're breaking state law. So in Rockland, good example, I spoke to a couple teachers, including the teachers' union president, who said they just won't do it. They're just not going to do it. They're not going to break state law to adhere to a policy of the board.
And we do have the state stepping in, California Attorney General Rob Bonta. I mean, he took legal action against Chino Valley Unified School District. What happened in that case? Because a judge did step in.
Right. Well, he stepped in and gave them a temporary restraining order to stop the policy temporarily while the court case goes through the process.
Any word from the governor?
You know, he hasn't really said much about this. I think when Rob Bonta said that he thought this would set precedent. So I don't really see that they're going to file individually against these other districts. I think they're hoping that this case will set precedent for everyone else.
Have you heard anything from the California Teachers Association about the policy changes and the impact this could have to teachers and staff?
You know, they're definitely out there helping their teachers' unions, but I think they're letting these individual unions speak for themselves. But, you know, teachers in Marietta told me that they were really apprehensive about this policy, that the mood on campus had changed. I heard the same thing in Temecula and in Rockland. The day after the policy passed, though, they said that people were showing up with their ally flags on, students and teachers. So it was a little more sense of hope, I think, in Rockland.
You know, we're focusing on school boards, but where do you see this potentially going in terms of how you're going to be following this as a journalist? I mean, could this lead to statewide or even federal legislation or even initiatives that go on the ballot that voters actually decide?
Well, there are three initiatives that aren't on the ballot yet that they're going to start collecting signatures for by Protect Kids California that want to do exactly that. They want to put the initiative on the ballot that would require schools to out students, to tell parents if a kid tries to change their gender or their pronoun. So that is definitely on the ballot coming up. It may not make the ballot. They have to get 550,000 votes, but it might.
Diana, thanks for the time.
Thank you.
Diana Lambert is a senior reporter with EdSource. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and we're discussing the recent policy changes at some California school districts, including Rockland, that will require teachers and staff to report transgender and gender nonconforming students to their parents. We just heard about how these policies are intended to work, as well as the legal backlash that they're facing from the state. Now we're going to learn about the real-life impact of reporting students to their parents. Anoush Dajorian is a director at Yellow Rainbow Families with the Davis Phoenix Coalition, and Ebony Harper is a human rights activist and founder of California Transcends, which works to advance transgender rights in the state as well as the country. Welcome to you both. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Vicky.
You know, often when we talk about debates that fall under culture wars, you know, the rhetoric can leave out people who are directly impacted by these decisions. It gets politicized. So in the spirit of humanizing what has become a heated issue, let's begin with the people that you serve and any lived experience that you wish to share. Ebony, I'll start with you.
Yeah. I like that you introed with that, Vicky. Personally, I'll start with my personal experience. I have the unique experience of coming out as a trans kid at 4 years old. As soon as I was able to articulate how I felt on the inside and noticed that I was different from the other boys, I was communicating that to my mom. My parents are pastors, so I was brought to church, to the prayer line, and I was spanked because I was acting, quote unquote, acting like a girl. So that led to being 13 years old, and I left home to Hollywood, where there was an overwhelming amount of other trans kids, and we had to participate in risky behaviors. We were homeless, sleeping in front of churches, and this was 1992, which was the norm for trans and queer youth, that most were runaways or put out, and we participated in, you know, underground economics, I'll put it like that. And we took hormones without doctor's supervisions. And a lot of trans folks got liver damage because these were like Premarin. I don't know if you're familiar with that medication. It's from a pregnant horse. And we would take those medications. And so fast forward to 30 years later, and things have gotten a lot better. And there was a point in time that I was like, wow, people are knowledgeable. Even conservative people were supporting their trans children and still are. It seems like that is all being fought back now. And you know, it's scary, and I'm worried about our next generation. But I'm going to fight. They got Auntie Ebony on their side.
Yeah, I was going to ask how it was making you feel, given that, you know, in the past 2 months, I mean, this is playing out at school districts. Did you ever anticipate or think that this was happening, would happen, especially since, you felt that, you know, we were rounding a curve.
I never felt that. I thought that we were progressing as a society, and our issues were other issues, cultural issues. Not that somebody's inherent humanity and who they are inherently. I thought that we had crossed that curve and people realized that people are who they are. And all we are, energy and matter, and energy is going to show up how it wants to. You can't legislate it away. And even if you do, these kids are still going to identify the way they identify. It can't be legislated away. And so I am surprised, but I'm also not surprised because of the way we have seen history. And so I am also hopeful. I see this generation as a generation that won't be swayed, and they had a taste of what it feels like to be free and to be themselves without pushback and rejection, and they're not going back. And so I feel bad that these people don't see that. And I also feel hopeful that our youth is, you know, gonna just be themselves and they're gonna push back.
Given that adults are making these decisions and you have that experience as a Black trans woman, especially, you know, identifying as trans at such a young age, what do you want adults to know about the harm that these policies could have on students?
Like I said, the harm could be conversion therapy. And we know countless stories of conversion therapy, depression, anxiety, which all leads to maybe children run away from home in overwhelming amounts, self-harm, self-mutilations. These are things that we were dealing with 30 years ago. These were absolutely happening in large numbers. Mm-hmm. And so it is imperative, even though don't let them play you on maybe you not understanding, you know, all the its and buts and, you know, medical terms, and just accepting that humans show up differently. And if you believe in a higher power, God didn't make us all the same. And that's the beauty of being a human. And just like flowers come in different sizes and different colors, and that's how humanity shows up. And so why wouldn't humanity show up as a big Black trans woman? Why wouldn't humanity show up as a trans youth? We have these labels, trans, but that isn't all encompassing of what the human is and who the human is. It's just the label. And so anyway, I just want people to realize that humanity shows up and just support youth's humanity.
Anoush, I want to bring you in. I mean, you're with Yolo Rainbow Families and with the Davis Phoenix Coalition. You know, talk to us about the people that you serve and the conversations that you're having about these policies that are happening at school districts.
Yeah, thanks so much, Vicki. So Yellow Rainbow Families, we have a number of programs that serve the LGBTQ plus community and particularly families. So I work with parents of trans kids. I work with trans teens. And we recently started a Rainbow Kids group because we're actually seeing kids coming out earlier. And instead of being told that they are not trans, instead they have supportive parents who are willing to let them be who they are. And so we have kids coming out earlier. And I want to point out something that was said before, which is that when school boards put out these policies, you have kids who are pushing back against these policies. And it's very apparent that the people who are pushing these policies to out trans kids don't have children who are speaking up to say that they need these policies. Whereas you have trans kids, you have other LGB kids, and you have allies again, who are minors. They are school-age kids, and they are speaking out against these policies because they know that these policies are harmful to children. They can see through these very flimsy arguments that somehow this is important for children, that that these policies exist. And so really the people who are directly targeted by these policies and the ones who will be affected are fully aware of the ways that these policies will harm them.
What do you think about the argument of a parent's right to know versus a student's right to privacy, Anoush?
Well, I am a parent and I have two children, and I always used to tell my kids that my first job is to keep them alive, to the point where I would ask my children, what is my first job? And they'd say, to keep us alive. So this fiction that parent choice means that the parent's right to know their child's gender identity supersedes their child's safety, it puts children in danger. You know, as Ebony has recounted, there is a very long history of children in the LGBTQ plus community. You know, we know that we belong to that community long before we come out. And for many of us, that was a secret that we kept from everyone. And it was a part of ourselves that we had to hide. So in this world that those of us who are LGBTQ plus elders fought for marriage equality, in order to be able to come out of the closet, in order to, you know, not get fired from our jobs for our identities, you know, children have experienced this world where they don't have to hide themselves. They don't have to be in the closet. They don't have to feel ashamed of who they are. And there's this movement to push backwards on that, to make those kids, you know, feel afraid for who they are, and to show the world, to show their teachers. And there, we do have documented cases of kids who feel comfortable at school, and so they come out to their teachers, but they know that their parents at home will not accept them. And, you know, we've heard very eloquently from people at public comment at these school board meetings of kids who have been through conversion therapy, kids who have self-harmed, kids who have considered suicide, who say that being able to enter a gender-affirming program, even being able to transition socially, which doesn't involve any medication or surgery whatsoever, those steps saved their lives. And so isn't that what we all want as parents, to have our children safe and alive?
You know, I also think it's important to bring up, you know, with these, I mean, these are very heated school board meetings. They take on hours and hours, an entire school board meeting. But we're also talking about a relatively small fraction of the student population at these school districts. Mm-hmm. And there is an enormous amount of time that's devoted to this.
Absolutely. And I think the hollowness at the center of parent choice and parents' right to know is the fact that it does affect so few children. And if these parents were truly concerned about child safety, they would be working on issues that affect far greater numbers of children and that are threatening children's safety and well-being every day. We could talk about gun violence. We could talk about housing insecurity. We could talk about food insecurity. You know, we were running a program during the pandemic where we were supporting families whose parents were unable to work. And these were families that had to make a choice between rent and food for their children. And a lot of times they were so afraid of being evicted, they would spend it on rent. And if we didn't intervene, their children would go hungry. And that, again, as a parent, that is a horrible choice that I would never want to make. And to know that some of the children in our community are still going through experiences like this, please spend this energy on helping those families.
You know, Ebony, I mean, when it comes to actually like the schools that have to potentially implement these policies. I mean, to your knowledge, is there going to be like training or resources available because you have school staff and administrators that, you know, might need the education, you know, about, you know, having to tell a parent about, you know, their child, you know, using a different pronoun?
Yeah. I actually looked up these policies and read them. And the journalist from EdSource said, they have a common theme, which they have weaponized biology. And I can make an argument that being trans is biological, you know. No, it's not about empathy, which has been considered like a liberal thing now these days. It is about politics and winning elections mostly. It's about the issue, because going back to what Anoush said, it's very minuscule, the representation of trans kids in schools. And so we think of, why is this happening? Because they feel like this can help them to win larger elections, and fueling fear and anger, which we have seen with multiple marginalized communities. Historically, you know, I'm Black. And so we've seen the weaponization of being Black in America, and maybe how desegregation was going to cause Black people to do harm to white folks. So this isn't nothing new. This is an old school playbook. And it's about harm. And it doesn't, I would make an argument also that it doesn't only harm the trans youth and the families, it harms allies. And they, you know, they have trans friends. And even if they don't, they have empathy towards mm-hmm. trans folks. And they don't want to live in a world where a trans person feels rejected or harmed. And so they feel that. And I'm glad you asked that question, because that is an empathy-based approach also. But we don't even need this guidance. We don't need these policies.
And finally, we only have a minute left, but, you know, for students who are just grappling with these school board decisions and they might feel lost or disheartened, you know, what would you like to leave them with?
I'm Auntie Ebony. And I am here fighting for you, and you are loved, you know, as Anoush said, by your trans elders. And we've been through this before, and I also believe in you, and I believe in the families of trans youth supporting their children. And I believe in the allyship. And another thing, you're not alone. You have family everywhere, and this too shall pass.
Anoush, what would you like to leave these students or youth with, since you work directly with them in Yolo County?
Absolutely. I've definitely seen how trans kids are heartened when adults stand up at these school board meetings and defend their rights. And there is a massive mobilization happening within the Sacramento area to support LGBTQ+ families in all of these school districts. And I mean, as Ebony pointed out, the hope is the youth. I mean, part of the reason why people are attacking these kids' rights is because this generation really understands these issues of justice and equity. And for them, gender identity is not a big deal. It's not something they worry about. They are very accepting of their trans peers. And so again, they can see the hollowness at the heart mm-hmm. of this campaign. And so, you know, these kids are not alone. They have support, you know, and again, we are not, as elders, we are not going back, and we feel very protective of our LGBTQ+ youth, and these kids are not going back either.
Anoush and Ebony, thank you so much for the conversation.
Thank you, Ms. Vicky, opening the dialogue for this conversation.
Anoush, appreciate it so much.
Appreciate both of you. Anoush Jajourian is the director of Yellow Rainbow Families with the Davis Phoenix Coalition, and Ebony Harper is a human rights activist and founder of California Transcends. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. These days, when it feels like everything is getting more expensive, the thought of taking a trip might make you think twice, but it can be a good idea to remember what we have right in our backyard for a quick, budget-friendly getaway. You have to look no further than El Dorado County, especially as we start transitioning into the fall months, and we all know that the leaves are going to start to turn and the beauty of the Sierra foothills are just around the corner. We stumbled upon a post by the El Dorado County Visitors Bureau, and we're just reminded about just how lucky we have it here. Joining us now is Jody Franklin, El Dorado County's Executive Director of Tourism, to share some of the top road trips. Good morning, Jody.
Good morning.
So what sparked the idea for putting together a road trip itinerary?
Well, basically what you just said is that if the pandemic taught us anything, is to explore our backyard, right? So, and we've got all these spaces. We want people to get off the main freeway and just take the road less traveled.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned, obviously, the pandemic, which was a couple years ago. I mean, it's still continuing. But even 2 years ago for your county, the Caldor Fire, I mean, it ripped through parts of El Dorado County, Amador, and Alpine counties. Talk to us about the recovery in the 2 years since and just the importance of having visitors back.
Oh, my goodness. It was just devastating, and to see all that, so many acres of forest go away, but really how it impacted the Grizzly Flat community there, and it still looks really devastating if you go there. They're cleaning all that up and everything, but we need visitors to come back. We need visitors to come back respectfully and put money into our communities and just bring us up. And they definitely have done that.
So given that it's almost fall, I mean, two things that come to top of mind are the fall colors as well as Apple Hill. So if someone's new to the area listening to this conversation, just kind of give us a preview, a little taste of what each of them are and how people can take part in it.
Okay, so what Apple Hill is?
Yes.
Okay, Apple Hill is not a place. It's a group of about 50 different apple farms, and some are large, some are small. I would say go to the small ones, you know, and everybody goes for something different. So maybe you want the donuts here, and you want the apple fritters there. There's apple cider, you know, if you're a cider, there's a cider trail there. So there's something for everybody, whether you have kids, don't have kids. Whatever, 50 different farms to choose from.
Yeah, and of course, lots of apples too when the season's right.
Absolutely. This is a crazy bumper year for apples. So if you know, last year was tough and the previous years because of the weather and stuff, this year they're telling me it's crazy how many apples we've got.
So you did hone down on four road trips, and there's really something for everyone, for all ages, whether on four wheels or two
yes,
wheels.
Absolutely.
So let's start with California's first road trip, and this really focuses on the history of the gold rush along Highway 49.
Exactly. So, you know, people go from Sacramento, let's say way to South Lake Tahoe, and they don't even know what's a mile off the freeway. You know, it's just like, just take that road less traveled. So first, let's start in Placerville. That historic Main Street looks a lot like a movie set, you know, the Old West movie set. But I would say kind of a hidden gem would be Goldbug Park and Mine. It's a hard rock mine, a gold mine, and it's 62 acres of park. So that in itself, and it's only a mile off the freeway. But then if you continue down Highway 49, we stop in Coloma, and that's where the gold rush began, right? That first nugget was picked up, made California a state. And then on through Georgetown, which is another really great western town, and up in the kind of the foothills there. Lots of fun stuff to see there, too. There's a art gallery there that I tell you, you got to stop at because it's so cool. People that live in that area are just naturally creative and independent, and you see that in their art there. And then it takes you back down Highway 193 back to Placerville. Mm.
You also have an itinerary called Leaf Peepers, and that's just in time for fall. I mean, the fall foliage is just, it really is exquisite in the Sierra foothills. So what do you recommend people do to take it all in the right way?
So we need that cold snap, first of all. So that'll start in the high country. So South Lake Tahoe, you go up Highway 50 South Lake Tahoe, and then take Highway 89 down through Hope Valley. Absolutely stunning. It hasn't started turning yet, but towards the end of the month, soon as we get a cold snap up there, you go. And then coming down, then Apple Hill will be, that area will be later in the season. So probably, I would say early November, really late in October, depending on the weather, that's where you're going to see that one.
Yeah, talk about going off the, you know, proverbial like beaten path. Like I actually, the first time I saw Hope Valley, I didn't realize that it was Hope Valley. It was during leaf season, and it was just stunning. It was the best thing to stumble into.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I just did that a couple of years ago, again, just to kind of remind myself. But all the different colors, it's not New England, but I tell you, it's very close. It's beautiful.
You also have an itinerary for not only food, but wine lovers. And people might not be aware that there is a great kind of wine industry of a lot of, you know, local growers in El Dorado County, a lot to offer for wine country. So what is the culinary tour of El Dorado County?
So I'm a foodie, and so this was like near and dear to my heart, this one. And wine. Anytime you've got good wine, you've got good food that goes with it. So it goes hand in hand. But it goes into the town of El Dorado. You may have heard of Poor Red's. That has a great history.
Famous barbecue.
Yes, absolutely. Across the street from that is a chocolate shop, Annabelle's. It is awesome. And they have local wines there. So that's a lovely way to start any day. And then you go down Pleasant Valley Road into the Rhone Zone. So those are a lot of Rhone varietals down there. I mean, throughout El Dorado County, we've got 70 wineries. So why go east or why go west? You can come east. Yeah. And though into Fair Play, that's also very like Deep Reds. That's awesome. And then back into Placerville.
That was also a place, Fair Play, that I stumbled upon, you know, unknowingly, you know, just taking, you know, hopping off Highway 50 and just exploring. I mean, it's a beautiful area. And then you find that there's some really wonderful wineries out there.
Absolutely. And it's that the sense of discovery, I think I love in every road trip I take. I don't care where it is. That sense of discovery. So you've already done it. You know, you've done exactly what we wanted to do with these road trips.
And then finally, you have the Hop on a Hog itinerary. What makes El Dorado County so special for those who, you know, want to take a motorcycle?
Well, the scenery. I mean, you can't beat it. So that one goes up and takes Ice House Road off of Highway 50 past Loon Lake. So you're going to see all this beautiful Sierras, lakes and rivers we go to. And then I love the names like Hellhole Reservoir. You know, who doesn't want to go to that? Stumpy Meadows, beautiful lakes. Not very populated, scenery spectacular, and then you come into Georgetown, and that's, like I said, very iconic history. Georgetown Hotel is a must stop. Georgetown Distillery is lovely as well. And then you come down into Coloma, and when you're coming over there, just the river view is amazing. And then they take that road trip takes Salmon Falls back to Highway 50,
You're bringing back a lot of memories. When I took Ice House Road, I found Union Valley Reservoir.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
And that one is just so beautiful. And as you mentioned, remote, which is perfect if you just want to enjoy the outdoors, you know, and maybe, you know, in the quiet in Mother Nature. Finally, you know, we only have a minute left. You know, there's a lot of good reasons to go to El Dorado County and take advantage of these road trips as we head to the fall season. So what events do you have coming up? Because you have a couple in September and you also have one in October too, correct?
Absolutely. There's several down on Main Street in Placerville. There's a block party. I think that's this weekend, the coming weekend. But on the 23rd, there's Girls Night Out, my personal fave.
What is that like?
Yeah, it is so much fun. This one is kind of a flower power, so a lot of ladies are going to be all dressed in the 60s garb. But then you've got discounts in all the stores, and it's a lot of ladies, and they're all having fun, just walking from place to place downtown. It's awesome. And then they've got music.
And then you have Gold Rush Live in Coloma in October.
Yes, and that is awesome, too, because that celebrates, you know, the Gold Rush, so they've got a whole tent town set up there. So you've got, you know, it looks like it did back in the Gold Rush with, you know, the period clothing and everything. And they have games for kids that were like them, you know, candle making and all that kind of thing. So that's lots.
Well, Jody, thanks for making exploring El Dorado County pretty easy.
Yeah.
Jody Franklin is El Dorado County's Executive Director of Tourism, laying out some itinerary of some of the best road trips to take in their stretch of the Sierra foothills. And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, email us at insight@capradio.org. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.